From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. How is our understanding of medicine today shaped by the past? Take mercury. Today, we think of it as a dangerous poison, but during the Civil War, medicinal mercury was used in various forms to treat many illnesses. We'll also hear about a syndrome affecting Civil War soldiers and veterans with symptoms like rapid heart rate and tunnel vision. A medical historian tells us it looked a lot like what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder.
At each point in time, a diagnosis is as much about the culture it exists in as it is about the actual symptoms.
That's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Later this week, the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, located in Frederick, will host its 24th annual conference on Civil War medicine. The event brings together scholars and amateur historians to discuss medical practices of a century and a half ago, the treatment of Civil War veterans, and the war's enduring legacy. This year's conference will include a session on 19th century dentistry and another on the federal government's response to an outbreak of cholera in 1866. This morning, we'll get a preview of two other presentations. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a condition that was called irritable heart that bears similarities to post-traumatic stress disorder. Right now, we're going to focus on medicine containing mercury prescribed during the Civil War. Our guide into why and how mercury was used is Guy Hasegawa. Since 1988, he has worked for the American Society of Health System Pharmacists in Bethesda and is an editor for the American Journal of Health System Pharmacy. Dr. Hasegawa is a member of the board of directors of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and a director emeritus of the Society of Civil War Surgeons. He's been publishing on Civil War medical topics since 2000. Welcome to On the Record.
My pleasure.
What were doctors using mercury to treat during the Civil War?
Practically any ailment you can imagine. It was used during the war probably as frequently as, say, Motrin is used today. They used it very frequently for constipation and for diseases that were thought to be of inflammatory origin, such as diarrhea, dysentery, pneumonia, and other diseases. But you can find documentation of mercury being used for practically any ailment that you can imagine.
Did it work?
Well, it produced effects that physicians thought were useful. It was thought useful to clean out the patient's bowel. Certainly did that. And that goal was kept in mind because it was thought that the bowel might contain noxious materials and needed to be rested. Whether if used today for the ailments that we see in our population, if that happened, we would probably not consider it to be effective.
Well, my sense, I mean, you're the expert, but my sense is today we think of mercury as quite poisonous.
That's true. And its toxicities were well known back in Civil War days, but it was thought that if it was used judiciously, it would be an acceptable treatment.
So even though they knew it was toxic, and even though you say they used it quite a lot, they thought they had it under control.
Some of them did. During the middle of the war, actually, one form of mercury in medicines called calomel was removed from the Union supply table by the Surgeon General because he thought it was being misused and was hurting patients more than it was helping. But other forms of mercury remained available to surgeons, and many of them thought that it was, again, useful if used in the right way.
Tell me something about the forms in which mercury was prescribed. You mentioned calomel.
Calomel is a chlorine salt of mercury. So it's essentially two atoms of chlorine for every two atoms of mercury. That was one of the oral forms given. Free elemental mercury, quicksilver, the liquid stuff that you see in thermometers, was also used, not by itself, but it was incorporated into pills called mercurial pills and into ointments that could be applied topically. And There's another commonly used form called corrosive sublimate that was given orally and was quite strong and quite poisonous if given in too high a dosage. So calomel probably was one of the more common forms used, and the mercurial pills, which were called blue pills because they were blue, that would be probably the most common other form given.
And these different forms, were they seen as being used for different ailments, or would a doctor perhaps use his trusty go-to method for all kinds of ailments?
The calomel and the blue pills, actually the blue pills were considered the most mild. So if you had a mild case or simply wanted a laxative, you would probably use that. Calomel was kind of the standard middle-of-the-road form that could be used for practically anything. Corrosive sublimate was used because some physicians thought that it didn't produce some of the gastrointestinal side effects as readily as the other forms, but it was a very powerful drug. So I think most would stick with either the blue pills or calomel. And ointment, you would think ointment would be used for skin afflictions, and sometimes it was, but primarily ointment was used because the mercury in that form was absorbed through the skin. So if you wanted to produce an effect not just with the oral form, you could add the ointment and get a quicker effect.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Guy Hasegawa, a member of the Board of Directors of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. He'll be discussing medicinal mercury at the museum's annual conference on Civil War Medicine later this week. How far back did such treatments go? How long had they been used?
That's hard to tell. I think we don't have records from when it was first used. There are some thoughts that Arab physicians were using mercury perhaps as early as the 8th century or so, and it started to be advocated in Europe maybe in the 16, 1700s.
And so what did physicians observe? You mentioned that at some point the Surgeon General removed it from the list of approved medicines. They must have been seeing some problems.
Yes. One of the effects that mercury was thought to cause was to increase secretions from the liver, from the gallbladder, from the intestinal tract, and secretions from the salivary glands. And salivation actually was supposed to be the first sign that the mercury was having an effect. So the patient would start salivating, and this could be up to quarts per day. The gums would get sore, the teeth might loosen. That was kind of an end point of dosing for most physicians. Once they noticed that, they would either back off or decrease the dose. But if it was too late or if you continued giving mercury, you could develop ulcers in the mouth and eventually necrosis of the gums, cheeks, and even the bones around the jaw. So that was one endpoint. Another endpoint would have been the laxative effect, because often that was what it was given for. So they would observe to see whether bowel movements were occurring and then perhaps back off after that.
Do we have any idea of whether treatment with mercury led to death, and if so, how often?
It could lead to death. Overdoses, for example, could lead to renal failure, convulsions, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea. Patients who, say, a suicide attempt or just took too much of a medicine could have those effects. And there was also a chronic mercury toxicity syndrome from people who worked around mercury or took lower doses of mercury as a medicine. And that would be manifested with tremors, unsteadiness of gait, psychiatric problems. So the term mad as a hatter, for example, came from the phenomenon that hatters who used mercury in making felt for hats were chronically exposed to mercury and developed the tremor and the psychiatric problems.
Why did you decide to study the use of mercury?
Folks who are familiar with Civil War medicine know that mercury was commonly used, but I don't think they know the real details about the various forms And being a pharmacist, I'm interested in where the stuff came from and how it was supplied. So some of that is included in my talk. So I think there's a general knowledge that it was used, but an appreciation for some of the details and little nuggets of information are not there for most people attending this conference.
Is it true that Abraham Lincoln took mercury?
Well, apparently. There's a group of authors that attribute some of Lincoln's erratic behavior before he became president to his taking blue pills. And I think there are records, prescription records or pharmacy purchase records that indicate that he was given mercury pills. Whether or not they were the culprit in his behavior, I don't know.
One of the things that has always fascinated me about the Museum of Civil War Medicine is the implications for today. I mean, for example, the lessons about triage help shape the way we do emergency medicine today. So what can we learn today in the 21st century from what you have found?
With mercury in particular, I think one of the most important things is to look at it in the context of what physicians knew then. Today, we think of mercury as this terribly poisonous substance that we would never expose anyone to, but you know, in decades from now, people will look back at what we're doing today and wonder, what were we thinking? And people will be asking someone the same sorts of questions you're asking me. So people during the Civil War era, the physicians were pretty smart guys, and they were trying to do their best for patients, and they were working with what they knew. So that's one of the big lessons, and not just particular for mercury, but for the entire history of the war that we have to keep in mind.
I really appreciate your sharing your insights with us. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Guy Hasegawa is a member of the Board of Directors of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and a Director Emeritus of the Society of Civil War Surgeons. He's also the editor of the American Journal of Health System Pharmacy. You can catch his presentation about medicinal mercury Friday at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine's annual conference in Frederick. Information at civilwarmed.org and on the record page at wypr.org. After a quick break, tunnel vision, heart palpitations, was a 19th century condition called irritable heart, a version of what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder? I'm Sheila Cast. This is On the Record. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Ashley Bowen Murphy is a doctoral candidate at Brown University. She studies 19th century medical history, and she'll be speaking at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine's conference in October. Her presentation, Rethinking Irritable Heart, Cardiac Condition or PTSD by Another Name. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
What is irritable heart?
It's a cardiac condition that was identified originally by Dr. Jacob DaCosta in 1862. Today, we would probably think of it as something like a panic attack, but they really did think that it was a cardiac disorder. So the symptoms are things like a rapid heart rate, anywhere from up to 190 beats a minute, so like a really fast heart rate, chest pain, difficulty breathing, tunnel vision or kind of blurring vision, difficulty sleeping, things like that. So I think when we hear that today, we're sort of like, oh, they're having a panic attack, right? That's like the classic symptoms. But DaCosta thought that it had something to do with the nerves in the heart.
So it was seen as a physical ailment.
Yeah, it was a physical ailment.
With a physical cause.
Well, they weren't sure about that. So they definitely were looking at what the configuration of the nerves in the heart might be, but this was considered a functional disease. So functional diseases don't necessarily have lesions or some kind of like malformation of the physiology or a marking. So they kind of wanted it both ways. So sometimes they thought that it was definitely the result of hard marching and an exhausted heart that like wore out the tissues of the heart. But other times they thought, well, it could be because of fear inducing this before a battle, or it could be someone who's just prone to melancholy or nostalgia, that kind of thing.
But they did. But some of the discussion around it did get to non-physical causes.
Yeah, it was definitely something they were thinking about because DaCosta, when he identified the condition, was never quite able to come to a specific cause. So they had a lot of things that they suspected might generate it, but he was never able to say that it was very specifically one thing.
Back up for me. How do you know any of this? What you can't interview these folks.
Yeah. So I do a lot of my research at the National Archives, where they have pension records for men who fought in the Civil War. They also have court-martial cases. So one of the things I look at are men who were brought up on charges either of desertion or cowardice, who then use their heart condition as part of their defense. And those cases are available there. I also look at diaries and letters, published medical records, DaCosta's own writings in like medical journals, medical textbooks, that kind of thing.
Tell us about DaCosta.
So he was born in 1833 to a Jewish family in the West Indies. They were in St. Thomas until he was about 4. And then he moved to Europe, where he studied for about 10 years. Then he moved to Philadelphia with his family as a teenager, where the family suffered a kind of a reverse of fortunes a little bit. And so he had to enter a profession and he decided to go to medical school. He went to Jefferson Medical College and studied under Dr. Mutter of Mutter Museum fame in Philadelphia. People may have been there. And when the war breaks out, he joins the army as an acting assistant surgeon. So he didn't travel with the army. He spent all of his time in Philadelphia. He was basically a contractor, probably is the way to think of it. Soldiers with cardiac diseases were sent to Philadelphia, and he was able to study them there.
So DaCosta is actually examining patients. He's not just reading reports about them by other doctors.
Yeah, he works the hospital wards, and he is there with a couple of other prominent physicians. They're all working in the hospital.
And how does he come to focus on this particular set of symptoms and see a pattern?
I'm not exactly sure. My research hasn't actually told me yet what specifically catches his eye. But in his writing about the condition, he talks about soldiers having cardiac conditions for a long time. So he says, this isn't exactly new. We've known for ages and ages that soldiers will complain about their hearts. But he also says that the knowledge of the nerves of the heart and the arrangement of that is very specifically the knowledge of our time, meaning 1860. And so he looks at a set of symptoms and says that these are consistent enough across patients and across time that we can call this a particular diagnosis and sort of set it apart from other kinds of chest complaints or heart complaints that soldiers might be suffering.
That's Ashley Bowen Murphy, who studies 19th century medicine here on the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a presentation Bowen Murphy will make about what doctors during the Civil War called irritable heart. To the extent that it was treated as a physical ailment, did doctors in the field notice they weren't getting results?
Yeah. So this is one of the things that's really interesting about DaCosta's writing. The treatment for the condition was often extended periods of rest, as well as kind of very gentle exercises and slowly returning back to duty. And DaCosta was really hesitant to send men back to their units too soon. And again, because I think the instinct can be to read this as a kind of panic disorder, he would say, oh, you know, he was fine. And then he rejoined his unit and relapsed. And of course, we all think like, yeah, of course, because he had to go back to the front. That was terrifying, I'm sure. So his treatment plan, he did use some drugs to treat it, but he really thought that it was rest and kind of slowly rebuilding the muscles and endurance that was going to be the main course of action.
And so the rest might have been good for other purposes than he realized.
Yeah.
What kind of drugs did they have?
So they were fairly, what we would think of as quite simple. So they used belladonna and aconite, and he did use morphine to treat the pain, but he was very conscious of not wanting to turn his patients into what he called opium eaters.
Drug addicts.
Yeah. So he didn't want to, he would use opium for pain sometimes, but he generally tried to use other kinds of drugs.
You got to know some of these soldiers pretty well mm-hmm. in your research. Tell us about Joseph Work.
So he's one of the patients that I was able to confirm that DaCosta treated. He was born in 1844 in Philadelphia, and he joined up with the Company I of the 12th New Jersey Volunteer Infantry in 1862. And his heart gives out basically on the march to Gettysburg. So it's a little unclear exactly what that means, but he struggled to keep up with his unit. He was having a hard time catching his breath, really rapid heart rate, that kind of thing. So he's evacuated to Philadelphia with the rest of the Gettysburg wounded after the war. And then he and DaCosta meet a couple of times over the course of Work's life. And DaCosta sees Work. He views him as this really successful case of the treatment. So he comes in and DaCosta describes him as puny and broken down and really ill. And then he's treated, he's released, and he joins the Veteran Reserve Corps, which was a unit that basically was a place for ill soldiers who were not so sick that they needed to be removed from the service, but could still do kind of light duty clerical work.
But not combat.
But not combat, yeah. So he serves for a little bit in Washington, D.C., then in Ohio. And DaCosta says, you know, and he was like mounted. He went outside. He did hard riding. He's completely recovered. You know, he doesn't have any trace of the condition. He can go up and down stairs. Sometimes he catches a cold. Like, that's what he says. But Work doesn't see himself that way. So in 1880, Work applies for a pension on the grounds of his heart condition. And he says that he'd never been able to do a hard day's work in his life after the war. And, you know, he says, I was hale and hearty. I was a farm boy before I went to war. And now even the lightest exertion leaves me prostrate. So he can't do stuff. One of the things that's really interesting to me and in my dissertation that I study is the ways in which physicians and patients don't necessarily see their illnesses the same way. So DaCosta sees it as, oh, he doesn't have a racing heart rate and he doesn't have chest pain anymore. He's healed. And Work sort of says, well, but I'm still sick. Like, I still can't do what I want to do. I can't support my family. I can't work. And he is awarded a pension, and he ends up having his pension for decades. And that's apparently how he mostly supports his family after the war.
Some of our listeners may have heard of World War I soldiers suffering mm-hmm. from shell shock, mm-hmm. what was called shell shock then. How has our understanding of the trauma of war changed over time?
Particularly in World War I, they were aware of DaCosta's work. So you'll see references, if you study World War I soldiers, to the Effort syndrome, DaCosta syndrome, or irritable heart. Those are all kind of synonymous. But by World War I, you know, Freud's already around. They're improving their knowledge of psychiatry as well as physiology. So they're able to segment disorders better in some ways than they were during the Civil War. So that's why you start to see people being diagnosed with valvular complaints, but also linking that to irritable heart. And then by World War II, you get into combat fatigue. And then by Vietnam, you get into post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, of course, what we use today. So these diagnoses are different, but they certainly form a kind of chronology over time. But I want to be very clear that although that's a convenient chronology, I don't necessarily think it's correct or appropriate to say that irritable heart is post-traumatic stress disorder just by a different name. I think they were looking at different things and they were thinking about the experience of combat and the experience of war very differently. And so it's worth seeing those in relationship to each other, but not necessarily thinking that they are synonymous with each other, if that makes sense.
Help us understand then, what can we learn from studying the physical and emotional issues of the Civil War? How does that inform what we understand today?
I think there's a couple of things, some of which are sort of very historical, like about the way that we understood the body, our knowledge of diagnostic techniques, stethoscopes, that kind of thing, right? So there's that part. I think the other thing that it can tell us is how as a culture, as a society, we understand the costs of war in a kind of abstract way. So I think some of the urge to find post-traumatic stress disorder in Civil War veterans tells us a lot more about us today and what we're thinking about in terms of the young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, how we're understanding what we ask people to do on behalf of their state. I think that there's something to be said for wanting to find echoes of the present in the past. I think that's a really comforting thing to do. I mean, it's like why I'm a historian, right? Like I want to use the past to understand the present. But I think in so doing, we can risk flattening the distinctions that are in the past about how people understood bodies, the limits of medical understanding, of social understanding at that time.
When you say that we shouldn't think of what they saw in the Civil War as PTSD, mm-hmm. is that because the method of fighting, the pressure of war was different in the Civil War than in wars being fought today? Or why isn't it appropriate to make an equivalency?
It's not so much about the quality or the kind of combat. What I'm speaking about is in some respects a kind of narrow distinction, but I think a really important one about the ways in which post-traumatic stress disorder is itself a historically contingent diagnosis that is very linked to the experiences and the realities facing people coming back from Vietnam. And that condition is our current best understanding, but there's very little to suggest that in another 20 or 30 years, we won't have a new understanding. Not necessarily better or worse, kind of like the ways that irritable heart is replaced by shell shock and battle fatigue, but that at each point in time, a diagnosis is as much about the culture it exists in as it is about the actual symptoms. So when I say that they're not synonymous, that's less a judgment about the kind of emotional toll that war took and is more about the ways in which a diagnosis is always linked to things happening in the culture around the person. So it's as much a medical question as it is kind of a social one.
I appreciate you making that point. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ashley Bowen Murphy is a doctoral candidate at Brown University. She studies 19th century medical history, and she'll be presenting on Civil War veterans and irritable heart at the National Museum of Civil War Medicine's conference. Information at civilwarmed.org and on the On the Record page at wypr.org. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kast.